We're now posting, so go ahead and start it up.
Hello, and welcome to Arcane Connection number 12. This week, we're going to be talking about Halloween and the supernatural in Ars Magica. And tonight, I have the great pleasure to be joined by Ben McFarlane. So, good evening, Ben.
Good evening, CJ. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. This is the first time we've tried to record with this new technology, and after the evening I've had, where I accidentally called a load of people using Google Hangouts, Hangups are what I'm going to have after that experience. It's a great pleasure to actually seem to have the technology going right for once. How's your week going? Are you preparing for Halloween?
It's been nuts, but yes. You know, we got the costumes all set for the kids, and I have been informed as to what costumes I am allowed to wear and not allowed to wear. So the squid-faced ski mask is in. The horrible, frightening, I think it's a Filipino like monkey god mask, that one's out.
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure what I'm going to wear at the moment. I did threaten to strip naked, paint myself green, and go as Slimer from the Ghostbusters movie. I thought that I had the physique to pull it off. But apart from that horrific image, I apologize to anyone who's actually listening to today's podcast. It's unusual.
Stab out their mind's eye.
I'm not actually doing anything, and normally I find myself at Halloween doing some kind of media event, because as you probably know, I work as a parapsychologist, and my partner's doing a PhD on apparitions. So ghosts and phantoms are something that's very dear to my heart, but we've had a number of write-ups on them in Ars Magica over the years, and I suppose we should start by saying, was Halloween actually celebrated in the Middle Ages? Do you know the answer to that?
I don't. I would have to go look.
Well, I don't think it was. Ronald Hutton's book, which is called Stations of the Sun, is a marvelous guide to different seasons and holidays and how they came about. And Samhain, or Samhain as it's spelled, Samhain, the Irish Halloween festival, is a time when perhaps we would expect the dead to walk. It's originally a Christian festival, and this confuses a lot of people because they believe it's a pagan festival, and it is now a pagan festival, very much part of the Wiccan calendar. But in the Middle Ages, I believe that it is simply as the Eve of All Souls, All Hallows. It is, you know, a major Christian event, but I don't think it's actually celebrated throughout most of Europe. So if you're going to be in a Rhine tribunal setting, it would be Walpurgisnacht, May Eve, the last day of April, that you would be your equivalent of Halloween. Perhaps in Hibernia you would have something like that. And there's various other regional customs about days of the dead and days when ghosts are said to walk. And indeed, almost every village would have some day where there would be a story of an anniversary haunting or the replaying of a tragedy or some local festival of the dead. But it's at a local level, and so I don't think we certainly don't have trick-or-treating. That seems to have developed, by the way, in 19th century England, and then made its way over, well, England and Ireland, and then made its way over to the United States, and then in the 1980s come back to us via America, which is why everybody now thinks it's an American thing here, and people say, well, why are we celebrating it, Halloween, it's not a British thing, is it? It's an American thing. So what's Halloween like in America? I mean, is it a big event this year? Is it still part of your culture?
Oh, very much. It is actually, as I understand it, the third largest holiday or second largest holiday after Christmas. And I believe if it's second, it's after Christmas. If it's third, it's after Thanksgiving. But I'm pretty sure it's second. A quick look over on Wikipedia for the history of it. Yep. Says that it was originally All Saints Day.
It's All Saints. Yeah, of course, it's All Hallows. That's what's getting me. So it's Saints, yes. Not Souls. So it's All Saints Day is November the 1st, isn't it? And November the 2nd is all Souls Day, the two being right next to one another in the old medieval calendar.
And it was introduced in 609 and then originally celebrated on May 13th, but then it was moved to in 835 to November the 1st. And then by the end of the 12th century, they had become holy days of obligation and involved traditions such as ringing bells for the souls in purgatory, and it was customary for criers dressed in black to parade the streets, ringing a bell of mournful sound and calling on all good Christians to remember the poor souls.
So you have the bonfire, which is originally the bone fire. You burnt bones and horse hair because the horrible smell was said to drive off the spirits of the dead. And the ringing of bells is another traditional way to drive off the dead. So when the dead come knocking at your covenant, what do?
You hide behind your aegis.
And that's the interesting bit. Now, of course, I've only recently got my head around the fact that the aegis needs to penetrate according to a strict reading of the rules. I know. I mean, I think for a lot of players, they still don't actually observe that rule, which means you can cast much higher aegis than halves. But with that rule in place, without using Wizards Communion, an aegis of about 20 is exceptional. But then again, how many ghosts are going to have a magic might of higher than 20?
Well, they would probably, I would imagine, be the ghosts of former sorcerers. They would probably need to be. And by the way, I am firmly in the camp that says the aegis does not penetrate. But that's me.
There's no right or wrong ruling on that. I mean, it was the whole penetration rules question is difficult, and it's one of those things where we could discuss it for hours without coming to a conclusion. Because some people say, well, for consistency, it should penetrate, and other people like me say, well, we've never played it that way, and it's not technically a hermetic ritual, so I don't see why it should have to follow strict hermetic guidelines. But, you know, when I'm writing, I always assume it does now, because I know that's the correct answer, according to David and according to others. So
the ghost of that horse still lingers on the Burke list.
Yeah. So, okay, I've got a problem. And the problem is that I'm a parapsychologist, and I spend a lot of my life writing about ghosts. An incredible amount of it, if you've ever seen my blog, is dedicated to ghosts, apparitions, and hauntings. But I don't actually think that the supernatural makes for very good role-playing games normally. I'll give you an example. I wrote the Parapsychologist's Handbook for Call of Cthulhu, and in that, it seemed like a good idea, and actually I came up with rules which I think do work, but I've played over the years quite a few ghost-based Cthulhu scenarios which don't work very well, because ultimately the players say, well, it's a ghost, what are we supposed to do about it? Now, there are exceptions. There was a wonderful adventure written back in the 80s called Spawn of Azathoth, which starts with a crisis apparition of the player characters wake up to see someone's head being devoured and them spasming and crashing around their room as an apparition. And startled awake, they go to their friend and find his horribly mutilated corpse, and that leads them into an adventure. But unless you use ghosts as a way of introducing a scenario, in most systems, the players can't do very much about them. So if you're playing in a modern era investigative game and what you're up against is ghosts or even a poltergeist, the question is, well, what do we do now? Now, that's not really an issue in Ars Magica, is it?
No. I mean, on the upside, as long as you've got a proper mentum or peridot specialist, hey. Open season. In fact, I think most people would find them to be actually a better source of I guess, forced education than anything else.
I think most mage, I just use them as a source of mentum weast, don't they? Render them down for what they can get. Use them in the next season in the lab. I mean, the problem is that it's quite easy to create spells that ward against the dead and to talk to the dead in Ars Magica. But the medieval ghost is actually a very strange thing. Have you ever heard of the Bylands Chronicle?
I have not.
Okay, the Bylands Chronicle is a medieval chronicle written in Yorkshire, which includes, I believe, 9 snippets about ghosts. And the ghosts there are unusual because they're not like our modern conception of a ghost. We tend to think of a ghost as transparent, it walks through walls, it lingers around and wails a bit, and sometimes they've got a motive, such as wanting their bones to be buried. That's a very traditional notion, that they've come in search of, you know, justice or to have their body properly interred. But in the Bylands Chronicle, there's one example. I think it's a miller, and he's leading a donkey down a lane with high hedge on either side. And suddenly, a ghost leaps over the hedge and lands in front of him, grabs him, wrestles him, picks him up, and hurls him through the sky. And he crashes down to the ground and is stunned, and the ghost chases after him and he runs away. But in that, ghosts are more like the writings of the 19th century horror writer M.R. James. They are physical entities, like the Draugr of Norse mythology, and they're very, very tangible and solid. There's nothing ethereal and spooky and, you know, spiritual about these ghosts that featured in medieval Yorkshire. And it's roughly our period. I think it is actually a little bit earlier. But it shows that the conception of ghosts has changed. So sometimes, if you're looking for a combat encounter, a ghost of that type, and as I say, I think they're very heavily related to the Norse Draugr, which are sort of barrow dwellers, might make for quite an unusual experience. But to the more traditional ghost, in Greco-Roman times, ghosts tend to appear in dreams, and they tend to be messengers. They appear as visions or dreams, and they convey information. So anyway, all of this is, by the by, it's just academic stuff about ghosts, because that interests me. But how do you use ghosts in your stories?
Well, let's see. A couple of different ways. We've used them as tormentors. I mean, you know, somebody who's chasing after a member of the covenant for a past wrong.
So when they kill some poor innocent washerwoman, the washerwoman's ghost turns up wailing for vengeance outside the door, frightening the locals, turning the milk off, scaring the chickens, and causing problems for them.
Yes, that works, and that works for, you know, harassing them when they're on the road better than when they're at home. Unless the ghost has the ability to possess someone. And then they can basically catch a rider inside the Aegis that way.
Oh, are they able to do that? Possessors are able to enter the Aegis, are they? I thought that was the case. But
I believe, as I've read it and understood it, yeah.
I believe that is the case in Realm of Power the Infernal, as I recall, yeah.
Yeah. And so we've used that one before. But then once they get inside, they have really a problem doing much, because they don't have a token, so they're very restricted. But it gets them inside, and then they can leap about and cause problems that way. But it does give them a chance to kind of learn what's going on the inside. And, you know, they're dead, so they can afford to be patient. So we use that. It also works nicely on the road for... because there is no Aegis to protect them. So you can do that way. We've used ghosts as, like I said, as educators. Somebody's captured a ghost and used it to learn a language. We had one, it was very funny, we had one guy who played a Jewish red cap, and actually I ended up rebuilding his character for 5th edition for an issue of Sub Rosa. But he had a ghostly warder, and so he had an advisor, and we said it was the ghost of his brother who kind of looked over him the whole time.
And ghostly warder's still in 5th edition, isn't it?
I believe it is, yeah. And so the idea was that this guy had promised his mother that he would watch over, you know, his brother until his brother died. And he died before his brother did, so he stuck around as a ghost, yep. Which was, you know, which worked well as a GM tool, you know, to kind of.
Well, as I recall, ghostly warder gives you a certain number of experience points. I think it's 100 experience points for the skills of the ghost, which you can then teach or use for the benefit of the person it's haunting.
Yeah. So we've used that one, and then we've had ghosts who've then been bound. We had one player who played a kind of spirit-focused Kriamon, and he used the ghost as a familiar. He ended up binding a ghost as a familiar.
Right. Well, ghosts are just part of the Halloween mythos, of course. I mean, I think there are so many ways that you can use ghosts in the game. And as you say, one of the best ones is to bring back the actual repercussions of their actions on the players if they do kill someone. But, of course, as well as ghosts, we've got, well, what else? Aliens in our modern world are sometimes associated with Halloween. and the alien encounters of the 13th century are the fairies. And they're frightening, they're amoral, they're bizarre, and they twist mortals into following strange stories. So I suppose the fairies who dwell on the edge of every village, or just outside where the village, where the boundary is between, you know, your settlement and the wilderness, and the fairies that creep around and come upon lonely travellers late at night as the sun goes down on the deserted roads, really are the equivalent of the modern alien. Would you agree with that, or would you use fairies in a different sense?
No, I think that's one way. No, I think that is right. I mean, we always joke that fairies consider people to be their personal playthings. And it's just the unseely ones don't mind breaking their toys.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think for me, the big difference with 5th edition fairies was this kind of move towards them as liminal kind of edge creatures of archetype, creatures of who just manipulate humans for their own inscrutable games. And that's actually very, very close. I thought Timothy actually did a magnificent job with that, or whoever it was who came up with that, because it's very, very close to modern UFO lore and the way in which, you know, encountering or seeing an alien suddenly can unsettle your life and make you do bizarre things and eventually lead you into... Anyway, enough of this. I'm going to head off all parapsychologically. But for Halloween, what else is creepy? Werewolves.
Yep.
Well, what do you know about werewolves? Because actually, I don't know a lot about them myself. They're not really my area of expertise.
They actually go all the way back to Roman times.
Yep.
And even older than that. There was actually a recent... You can even take it back into the Bronze Age and various warrior tribes on the Russian steppes. They recently found a tomb of what were called dog warriors, but guys who wore the skins of wolves over their heads. I kind of think that's a starting point, possibly, for the werewolf myth. But the werewolves in Roman period could, freeze you in your place with a glance. They turned just into a wolf. None of the hybrid, part man, part wolf, is a more modern invention. And I guess by modern, I mean like 15th, 16th century.
We've got the cynocephaly, the dog-headed men. I mean, St. Christopher was originally a 7-foot-tall dog-headed man, was he not, according to some myths?
I believe so. There's one of the Plinian races.
Very strange, actually. There's a whole series around Leicester, Nottingham, Derby area, the English Midlands, of sightings of dog-headed men over the years. I noticed that they do tend to be focused in the Midland, and the Fortean Times, which is a wonderful magazine dedicated to unusual phenomena, has been running for years now the stories and letters from people who claim to have had encounters with dog-headed men while standing on tube stations or walking down paths, and, you know, they just appear perfectly normal, dress normally, but have the heads of dogs. And I find that really quite creepy.
That is. That's a crazy one.
I
know that the Roman ones could freeze you with a glance. They actually, the one story talks about a guy who sees his friend turning, standing in place. He takes off his clothes. He looks at his friend and freezes him in place with a glance. Takes off his robes and lays them on the ground, then pees a circle around them and says to his friend that when he can move again, should he try and reach in on his clothes, he'll be frozen in place, then turns into a wolf and runs off into the forest.
And that was marvelous.
Yeah. So, and those guys carry on. I mean, that idea of the men who turn into wolves, that goes through into France and that's much later too, but the legend of, is it the Beast of Gévaudan, I think?
Yeah, Gévaudan. Yeah, it's on sort of between, it's the border of Provence proper, Arlat, and I'm not sure what the area is on the other side, up towards Troyes, but yeah, that whole area there on the middle western part of France, and it's the 17th century, isn't it, that the beast actually causes massive depredation and kills many people and is hunted.
Right.
I think it might even be going into the 18th century, but yeah. And I mean, wolf legends up there above the Massif Centrium, werewolves were
massive central, were a massive part of the folklore of the region. And of course, they were across that whole area, even up into the Alps, there were werewolf legends. And Scandinavia, of course, has got plenty of stories of skin changers.
Yep, the idea of wearing a wolf skin, and this goes back to where they, some folks have thought, like I said, that this may be coming from an original kind of cult out of the steppes, right? Are these fearsome warriors who wore wolf skins. And they found this tomb where they have sacrificed, I think it was something like 15 wolves and like 20 dogs. And they could tell they were sacrificial by the marks on the bones and whatnot. But, you know, that this had been kind of like a ritual tomb for these warriors, and they're buried with these other animals. And so they thought that maybe these ideas of these fearsome warriors, you know, who were unstoppable with the heads of wolves, or with, you know, who were wolves, kind of sprang out of these Bronze Age cults. It's kind of an interesting idea.
And I mean, those, they could have ended up quite easily in the Pomeranian forests and be the very tradition that Berna, who fled to form Bjornair after she joined Trianoma and then turned herself against, you know, those shape changers are the ancient enemies of House Bjornair. Perhaps that's who she's hunting.
And we carry it into the game even with the skin changer virtue.
Yeah, the skin changer virtue, which of course mirrors parts of Celtic mythology as well, because in Celtic mythology you have the capacity to turn into a raven or a hound and various other, you know, skin changing types. And I mean, again, we find it in Norse mythology, so it's almost universal. So shame we don't have it more of it nowadays. You know, what do you do for a living? I'm a skin changer. would certainly make for a more interesting day than I have.
It's way better than customer service.
Well, yeah. Well, it'd go well together, wouldn't it? But the Strigoi, the witches. Witches are very, very much part of both Ars Magica and very much part of our Halloween celebrations. So how do you use witches in your games?
Oh, goodness. I hate to say it, but for a lot of times, the poor folk witch is kind of like the shakedown character, right? She ends up being kind of the middleman between hermetic society and regular civilization a lot of times, right? Because she's not always, the folk witch is not always a gifted character, you know, but she might use some of the folk witch out of hedge magic, right? I use that a lot. But so she ends up more or less, because she's nowhere nearly as powerful as the hermetics. I end up having a lot of poor folk witches who end up getting, you know, shaken down for weas, or kind of used as eyes and ears for a magi in various regions.
Useful potion saleswomen, as they sometimes appear as.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they are fantastic characters, but they're not sinister characters. I think, actually, if I remember my theology correctly, I could be wrong on canon law here, but I think in 1220, it's still an offence to believe in witchcraft. Witches don't exist in the eyes of the church, or are not regarded as powerful unless any power they have comes from, you know, the evil one himself and is allied with the infernal. I don't actually think witches are particularly persecuted by the medieval church, which surprises a lot of people. You're more likely to be denounced if you start hunting witches on the grounds that witches don't, you know, have any magical power or supernatural power according to the church in the period. That changes very much in the 15th century, but it's much, much later. Because, of course, in 1220, the time that Ars Magica begins, the Holy Office, what becomes the Dominican Inquisition, doesn't actually exist as such. The Holy Office only comes into existence, if I remember rightly, around 1227, and is for the express purpose of wiping out heresy. And so witches are not, in the period we're talking about, the old crones who fly on broomsticks and are seen as sinister that they later become. They're just seen as harmless herbalists and nutty women who know some strange science, I think. I could be completely wrong there. I mean, you know, I'm not an expert on the history of witchcraft by any means, but that's the impression I get.
I haven't gotten a chance yet. I live here in the northeast of the U.S., so I haven't had a chance yet to go to, and I only moved, well, I only moved here 10 years ago. I haven't had a chance to go up to Salem for the for the witch.
So, you know, Salem's a funny one because people always think that Salem, because mainly because the influence of Nathaniel Hawthorne, they think Salem was the example of Puritan bigotry, and it was, you know, superstitious, isolated backwards Puritans who turned around and persecuted harmless old crones. But actually, I recently read the trial records in some detail, and I noticed that it was the who's who of elite American society of the time. It's only, what, 20 miles from Harvard?
I think so. It's very close.
And most of the people, I mean, I don't think there was, I don't think there has been any court case in American history which has had such an astonishing number of great men of science, members of the Royal Society, scholars, learned jurists. It was a veritable who's who of academic excellence for the period. And they were far, far, far from superstitious backwards Puritans. They were extraordinarily, you know, learned men who conducted the Salem witch trials, which leads to the question of, you know, how do hermetic covenants view hedge witches? Do they use the join or die, or do they have another approach? How do you deal with that in your game?
Like, well, you know, we haven't, the few times we've had them in there, they've ended up, they haven't been join or die, because for the most part they've been very much minor hedge wizards. You know, their powers are by initiation. And they've usually been isolated practitioners. I haven't actually tried doing a full coven. I think with a full coven where they were initiating and kind of building their own power, even if it was on a small basis, I have the feeling my players would probably approach them with a join or die attitude, especially because we're looking at we've started up a saga in the Theban Tribunal, and so I think the just the specter of the Witches of Thessaly, that reputation alone is going to put the players on a you know, join or die footing, rather than a let's shake them down kind of attitude. How about you?
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, we're currently playing in a Theban Tribunal saga, but it's about a House Bjorne covenant that's down in one of the islands, and so the Witches of Thessaly haven't yet featured, and in fact, they're so wild and primitive, we stress the kind of wild, they're not actually wild and primitive, but that's what everyone thinks they are, but we stress the natural aspects of life in the Mediterranean and the animal life, and so the game hasn't really dealt with that. In the past, when I've dealt with witches, they have usually been simply an alternative source of authority to the player characters, and there's nothing worse than finding your covenant folk are going to the wise woman in the woods, or, you know, the wise woman three villages down who lives in the cave, rather than coming to you for, when they have a problem. And I think that there's a whole, there's an amazing amount of scope for the witch in Ars Magica, but are they really scary? Well, maybe. So what else do we associate with Halloween? Demons, I suppose.
Sure. Demons, and monsters of various kind, but demons too. The devil, people always dress up as the devil.
Yeah.
On Halloween.
Actually, you don't see that very much over here in the UK. I don't know why. Maybe it's because, well, we're a very secular society, and I don't think the devil has a great deal of resonance in our society. I mean, if you look at American pop music, selling your soul to the devil, you know, going back to the Mississippi blues tradition, it was a big thing, wasn't it? Even Hendrix jokes about it. But in Britain, apart from Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones, there's not a lot about that. Sorry about that. That was my phone going off in the background. So, yeah. I think the biggest problem I have in Ars Magica with dealing with themes of the supernatural, though, is think about your average horror film. Isn't it usually something like the high school kids go to the creepy old house in the woods, or the high school kids, you know, have a party on Halloween and the hockey mask wearing maniac with a chainsaw or whatever kills them one by one?
Yep.
And you've got the survival horror thing, which is quite big, and you've got the isolated location, individual threatened thing. The Woman in Black by Susan Hill is the second, and the first, I guess, is more stuff like Friday the 13th or The Evil Dead. The problem you've got with this in Ars Magica is Magi are not high school kids who are, you know, running away and trying to survive the terror. Magi are massively competent powerhouses of spiritual power who can just, even without going to the church, which is always going to be one option, can usually manage to kick together a spell, burn some weas, and send your monster of the week burning straight back to wherever it came from.
There's, yes, and if not that, then they can usually spin up a, they can usually spin up some kind of effect to either get you out of the situation, or, you know, you hold them off it.
From it.
Exactly. There's really so many ways. So it ends up being you'd have to have, you know, the few times where we've been able to do that kind of thing. For instance, one time we had a series of small demons who had possessed a large number of ravens.
Cool.
And so the ravens that, right, these became kind of like the warped creatures. It became a matter of, because more or less they're mundane ravens, but they've been, you know, commanded to do something. And so they don't have a might, per se. You know, a person who's been commanded to do something, that the parma doesn't protect you from their fists. And so, you know, and that, by the same token, these ravens basically had like an episode, you know, the old Hitchcock movie, The Birds, right?
Yes.
Swarmed a wizard. And he was more of a ghost wizard. He did not have a lot. He was a titleless, straight to true to form. He was a titleless who had specialized in Weim and in demons. And yeah, that didn't draw any suspicion. But the demon, you know, the commanded ravens proved to be a real problem. It was by, you know, it was almost, I guess, the demons became secondary, but we knew what we were going into, this idea of so many bad guys, you know, the overwhelming by numbers became the scary part of it. Because, sure, they're overwhelming powerhouses, until you get them, you know, until you start to get them tired, or until they botch. And the more they're casting spells, you know, the more chances they have to botch. And then it's a party.
I'll tell you what, there's another type of apparition we haven't discussed, maybe because it's not very Halloween, which is the apparition of saints, the appearances of saints. And if there's one thing that really can scare an Ars Magica group of magi, it's dealing with a saint. Especially a saint with an irascible temper whose, you know, devotees they have managed to upset. Have you ever used saints much in your games, or?
No, you know, and I have to say, doing some research, I'm starting to lean more in that direction, finding, you know, ways to incorporate the divine more into the game, because I think you're right. The divine becomes a very scary aspect for Meiji, because, you know, it seems so rare that Meiji act with self-restraint or in an apt manner. I tend to find most groups of Meiji tend to revel in their power, and so when the angels or the saints start showing up, they kind of freak out, because it's like, uh-oh, somebody's watching where I'm stepping, and they have the moral authority to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some great advice, actually, in Against the Dark on running horror stories in Ars Magica, and I think we should have maybe I should have looked at that before we started to talk about it tonight. But as Halloween is close upon us, I mean, how do you set about creating a tone of dread in a game? Years ago, running Call of Cthulhu, I managed to scare two of my players to the point where they accompanied one another to the toilet, which I was very proud of. And years later, playing a game called Cult,
I played a one-on-one session in which I managed to scare one fellow so much that he wouldn't go back, he wouldn't walk back home. But sometimes it's just down to the players, and sometimes it's down to atmospherics, and sometimes it's down to their realization that you're signaling that what you're telling is a ghost or horror story, and that, you know, they should respond appropriately. It is quite hard to do in ours, though, because it's so mechanically based that you lose that spirit of the moment from time to time. Or have you found ways around that?
Well, I think a session where you're playing Grogs is an excellent way.
Absolutely.
To do it. If you bring everybody down out of the Meiji, right? You stick everybody in companions, or you stick everybody into characters who don't have, you know, awesome cosmic powers. You can do that, but that requires, you know, in some ways you got to address that ahead of time with the group and be like, whoever it is, I don't know if you have. It depends on whether your sessions have multiple Meiji in the session, or
not
if you have just one.
One or two now. We used to end up, because everybody wanted to play their Meiji every single session, and it became ridiculous because the Grog's companions never got a look in, and it's not really Ars Magica.
Right.
And so now we have a couple of people playing Grog's, a couple of people playing companions, or everybody has a Grog, and some people play their companions, and a couple of them play their Meiji, or maybe one. But I'll tell you something I've picked up that you might find fun. When people tell ghost stories, their voices often change. They start to whisper, or they talk in a quieter method, in a quieter way to normal. They leave longer gaps. And they tell the story very sincerely, very quietly, but their tone of voice changes. And you can tell by their very tone that what they're saying is something that they find unsettling, or something that they find not quite normal, and they find hard to talk about. And sometimes if you do that in a game, as I just did, I dropped my voice and started to talk in a different way, you can convey that air, that air that, you know, you enter the building. The shadows seem darker than usual. There's just an air that something isn't right. You can hear the noisy buzz of blue bottles, but the air seems warm, almost sticky, as if, is the blood on the floor? No, it's just a nasty puddle of black ichor, but somehow the corners of the room, the more you look at them, was that a spider scuttling? No. Okay, what do you do, guys? You know, you mess around with tone of voice, you can play around with lighting and ambience, but at the end of the day, players, to get into a game, you have to signal to them in some way that it is going to be that kind of session. I think Ars Magica does cope with it much better than most role-playing games. I think, you know, in many ways, Ars Magica is the perfect game for, the perfect system for a Halloween game, because the protagonists are capable and can do something about the supernatural entities. But so do you run many games like that? Have you tried to scare your players?
I have not yet. It's been a while since I've actually had a table functioning around Halloween. So we're supposed to play next weekend. So I may see about taking it in that direction for that.
Well, one thing I will say is that the Medieval Chronicles are deeply weird things and filled with some very, very unusual experiences. And if you ever want a source of Halloween scares for your players, just go back to the sources and have a look at real folklore, because much of it's terrifying. This has been Arcane Connection, number 12, our Halloween special. I'm CJ, and I'd like to say thank you to Ben, and wish you all a very happy Halloween. Happy Halloween.
Thanks for having me, CJ, and yes, happy Halloween.